Good morning. Here's one more chance to hear the presidential candidates at length. Donald Trump spoke at Madison Square.
Good morning. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Apologies for that. We are bringing you election coverage today. Coming up, the Pennsylvania Attorney General's race, how each of the candidates will be tackling the opioid epidemic in the Commonwealth, plus the latest voter information for early voting in Ulster County. County Executive Jen Metzger joins us. Plus, we'll talk about the newly released budget and the upcoming hearings about it before it's adopted. Plus, safety for Halloween, fire safety. Fires with decorations and costumes cause damage and potential injury. We'll find out some safety tips coming up. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden is drawing controversy for a remark yesterday to supporters that appeared to refer to supporters of former President Donald Trump as, quote, garbage. The White House says that's not true. Biden was referring to a comedian at a Trump rally last weekend who called Puerto Rico a, quote, floating island of garbage. Trump held a rally last night in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He compared Biden's comment with those of Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election.
Remember Hillary? She said deplorable. And then she said irredeemable, right? But she said deplorable. That didn't work out. Garbage, I think, is worse, right? But he doesn't know. You have to please forgive him. Please forgive him, for he not knoweth what he said.
Trump will campaign today in North Carolina and Wisconsin. Vice President Harris gave a major speech last night on the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., near the White House. She spoke at the same place where then-President Trump addressed supporters on January 6, 2021. Many of them later attacked the U.S. Capitol. Harris says Trump would govern as a person filled with grievance and a list of enemies. She also focused on how she would address pressing issues if she is elected.
For years, we have heard excuses about why America can't build enough housing. Enough with the excuses. I'm going to cut the red tape and work with the private sector and local governments to speed up building and get it done.
Harris campaigns today in North Carolina before going on to Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Israeli lawmakers have passed a bill that bans the U.S. from reopening a consulate in Jerusalem that serves Palestinians. Other countries are banned from doing the same. The U.S. consulate was closed by former President Trump in 2019. President Biden has said he would reopen it, but has not yet done so. Israeli leaders oppose Palestinian claims to establish a future capital in East Jerusalem. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported the U.S. economy grew at a solid pace in the late summer and early fall. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 140 points in early trading.
The nation's economy grew at an annual pace of 2.8% in July, August, and September, with strong consumer spending leading the way. Consumer spending rose at a 3.7% annual rate as people spent freely on both goods and services. GDP was also boosted by exports and spending by the federal government. Growth was slightly slower than the previous quarter and slower than forecasters had expected. That's largely due to a drop in inventories and housing investment. The report card comes just days before the U.S. presidential election, in which the economy has been top of mind for many voters. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 150 points. You're listening to NPR. Along with choosing a presidential candidate, voters are also deciding a handful of Senate races across the country. NPR's Deirdre Walsh says Democrats are facing strong Republican challenges in several states.
It's a very tough map this year for Democrats, and right now, Republicans appear to have the edge to pick up enough seats to win control. They're expected to win a seat in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin's retiring, and are in good shape in Montana, where it's a solidly red state, where Democratic Senator John Tester has been trailing his Republican challenger. Democrats are just defending more seats in purple states than Republicans are.
NPR's Deirdre Walsh reporting. In Orange County, California, an ambitious project to turn wastewater into drinking water has long been underway. As NPR's Ping Huang reports, it's now a model for other places facing water scarcity.
The Orange County Water District has created several man-made lakes, but Ben Smith, a director there, says the water in these lakes doesn't stay for long.
It percolates, it goes down through the soil, It will spend several months traveling slowly through the aquifer until it reaches a production well where a city or a water agency will pump it out of the ground and serve it to the homes and businesses.
That water is recycled wastewater, which gets filtered and cleaned to drinking water standards and then piped out to refill these man-made lakes. The system creates enough water to serve the needs of 1 million Orange County residents. Similar projects are being developed in Texas, Arizona, and Virginia. As climate change shifts water patterns, it's a way to shore up the local water supply. Ping Huang, NPR News.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger last month announced an innovative budget for 2025, highlighting an array of initiatives aimed at addressing critical community challenges while maintaining a flat property tax rate. She's joining us this morning to talk about that, plus the latest on early voting in Ulster County. County Executive Jen Metzger, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be back on your program.
Thank you for joining us. And as I mentioned, we'll talk about the budget, but since early voting started this weekend in Ulster County, can you tell us about how that's going? We've seen some record numbers throughout New York State so far. How's it going in Ulster?
Yes. Well, that includes Ulster County. As of yesterday afternoon, late afternoon, close to 17,000 people voted early. So, it's a little over 4,000 voters a day on average. It's particularly heartening to me because this was when I was in the state Senate. This was, one of the key election reforms that we passed. And it's just, it just makes it so much easier for people to vote. New York always had such huge hurdles to that. And now we're really seeing the difference it's making.
Yeah, the Republican Elections Commissioner John Quigley and Democratic Elections Commissioner Ashley Torres said that these numbers are more than the last time that folks were able to do that, which was the 2020 presidential election, when 29,000 ballots were cast during the entire 6-day early voting period. So on pace to surpass that. And again, early voting continues in Ulster County through this weekend, the third. Sorry.
Yep.
Then on your website at elections.ulstercounty.ny.gov, there are the six locations listed there in
That's
the
right.
different areas.
We have six locations. I voted. I usually vote at the New Paltz location. This time I voted. I went with my mom on my lunch break to vote here in Kingston. And again, it just makes it so much easier if you can go, from work, you can go, on your own time. But there are long lines, but, my personal anecdotal observation was that, people were completely fine with those lines. This is a very important election, and people are turning out, and they're being patient and waiting to vote.
Well, according to the elections commissioners, you were at one of the places voting where the heaviest turnout was. That was at the New Paltz Community Center, where 3,300 residents cast ballots in the first 3 days of early voting. So leading the charge there, I guess.
Although this time I voted in Kingston. Usually I vote in New Paltz.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
This time I voted near my office in Kingston.
The Andy Murphy Midtown Neighborhood Center in Kingston. 3,200 residents voted,
That's right.
Including you. Okay,
yep.
Good to know.
Yep.
And again, there's more early voting information, election information at the county's elections website. Let's talk about the budget. Last month, you proposed a $432 million proposal that holds the same tax rate as the previous year. Let's talk about how that is working. I know there's going to be some hearings coming up, but You are you're aiming to reduce the county borrowing with some dedicated surplus funds, like the new $10 million bridge reserve. Let's explain how the strategy will benefit taxpayers in Ulster over time.
Sure. So, you know, I, you know, look, when I'm, when we're developing this budget, I'm, you know, thinking about, you know, the fiscal health of the county, not just today, but, you know, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. We're in a very strong position today. You know, we just got our annual fiscal stress score from the comptroller. The comptroller, all local governments get a fiscal stress score, and we have the lowest possible score of zero fiscal stress. We just got our double A bond rating, and we're in a very good fiscal position today. And we have some surplus funds that we can use. And this is the second year in a row I've done this, to create reserves, which there have been a couple of different types of reserves. This two reserves that I created this year, or that I'm proposing to create, because they have, all of this has to be is, you know, in the process of legislative review, and ultimately the legislature has to approve the budget in December. But the reserves, you know, we have a big capital plan, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of projects in the pipeline. A big need is our, you know, physical infrastructure investments, roads and bridges. Ulster County has, you know, there are 62 counties. We're in the top five in the number of bridges we have in this county. There are like close to 400 bridges. The county owns and is responsible for close to 160 of those. And, you know, we're also a very rural county. So it's like a lot of infrastructure for a small tax base to keep up with and keep, you know, be able to pay to keep in good shape. So I've proposed to create a $10 million bridge reserve. And what that does is reduce the amount we have to borrow. We, as I said, you know, we have a great bond rating, and we can borrow it at fairly low cost, but there is still a cost to that. So you literally can save millions of dollars in borrowing costs over the years. That's paid for through the operating budget, you know, paying down those bonds. So if we can create reserves with surpluses today, it's just the prudent financial thing to do. Last year, I had proposed, and the legislature had approved two reserves, one $18 million reserve for, we're building a new general operations center, emergency operations center, and that will, again, reduce the cost, the bonding cost that taxpayers ultimately would, you know, be on the hook for. And we created an $18 million decarbonization reserve, the first in the state, probably the country, for our county, making investments in our many buildings and facilities to improve energy efficiency, invest in renewable energy, and reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. So all of these, again, these are all improvements we need to make, we have to make to our buildings. And if we can pay for them, pay for a good portion with our reserves, that's less we have to borrow.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger. We're going over the proposed $432 million budget. Your budget also includes, well, your budget includes 11 priorities. You mentioned one of the big ones, which is the bridges and roads. Housing, another big initiative for you. And you're launching a new Better Homes for All initiative. Let's tell folks about what that is.
Sure. So, two kind of top priorities of mine have been both, you know, housing and sustainability, climate and sustainability. And really this program, you know, joins those goals. Essentially, you know, we so Better Homes for All is the goal of the program is to connect our low and moderate income households with state and federal programs to improve their homes. So basically make them more efficient, you know, weatherized, insulated, and, you know, just, you know, using more efficient appliances. All of this, like, improves the quality of their indoor environment, like, reduces, like, their comfort, their health, reduces draftiness, you know, reduces, you know, other, you know, safety and health risks, reduces their energy bills, and also reduces their climate impact. So there are so many reasons to make these investments in our homes, but our struggling households can't, even though they'll benefit long-term from savings on their utility bills, they can't afford the upfront cost. So we have programs, there are existing state and federal programs, and the counties are in a very unique position to help ensure that our low and moderate income households are taking advantage of it, because counties are in the service business. So we're already connected to so many of these households through the provision of HEAP and SNAP services, through services to the through the Office of the Aging, through our Veterans Services Department. So this is a program that kind of leverages these you know, advantages of county government to really improve the housing for those that, you know, can't afford to make investments and that need those investments most. And also kind of integrated into this is a new state law that all county departments of health are responsible for implementing to eliminate lead hazards from rental housing. So our Department of Health, and this will be the case in every county, will be inspecting and ensuring that landlords remediate any lead hazards. We have over 4,000 rental buildings that our health department has to inspect. This all goes into a state registry. Again, this was a recent state law that was passed. All of this information is tracked. And the goal, again, is to improve the quality of people's homes, improve, like, reduce and eliminate health and safety risks, and just, create, you know, our home. We spend a lot of time in our homes, and they should be as safe and as comfortable and as least cost as possible, especially in this extremely expensive living environment we're all in right now.
And speaking to that, how does the proposed budget address eviction and homelessness? What kind of support is there for those areas?
So we have the legislature this year approved a program, an eviction prevention program, and my budget extends that program through 2025. And what that program does is provide legal services. We have a contract with Legal Services of the Hudson Valley. They also have, like, caseworkers. So it's not just legal services. It's also, like, assistance to renters in other issues that may make it challenging for them to pay and keep up with their rent. Basically, it's meant to provide them with legal assistance in staying in their homes. And we've also, using ARPA funds, created a fund that legal services can draw on to reduce arrears, any rental arrears that renters may have that may be the cause for eviction. So it's a very important program. I mean, we're working to expand through our Housing Action Fund the development of new housing that people can afford. There's $3 million in the budget allocated from our Housing Action Fund for that for 2025. But it's not just about, creating new housing. It's also about helping keep people in the homes that they're currently in and preventing homelessness and housing instability.
I want to take a quick break and come back and talk a little bit more about the initiatives, including public transit. Just hang on for one second. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, sure. And we're talking to Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger. More after a quick break here.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a Futuro investigation into Spanish language mis- and disinformation targeting Latino communities ahead of the presidential election.
They want you to act based on fear, on an emotion that you can't control.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
On the TED Radio Hour, clinical psychologists John and Julie Gottman are marriage experts. And after studying thousands of couples, they have found...
couples who were successful had a really different way of talking to one another when there was a disagreement or a conflict.
How to be brave in our relationships. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're returning to our conversation with Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger. We're talking about the proposed $432 million budget, which was laid out by the county executive last month, highlighting an array of initiatives aimed at addressing critical community challenges and maintaining a flat property tax rate. One of those initiatives that you're focused on with some innovation is public transit. Talk a little bit about Ulster County's public transit services.
Sure. So Ulster County has what I think is, a really great public, bus service. Ulster County Area Transit, or UCAT, as we all affectionately know it as. And for a rural county, I feel that, we provide fairly robust service because it can be challenging in a rural county, but we're always looking to improve that service and meet new needs. My budget keeps service free in Ulster County. Our bus service free. We started offering free service a couple of years ago, and we have seen a significant increase in ridership as a result. And I want to point out that, a lot of our state funding, the level of state funding is very dependent on ridership. So we actually get more state funding with increased ridership. So it more than offsets, what we're losing in revenue for charging each rider. So we want to keep that free. It's very important for our community and helps them out. And we have been undertaking, we had a consultant that has been developing a route optimization assessment that is based on, a lot of data numbers crunching, but also a lot of public input. There's been an incredible amount of public input on, why people use UCAT, what do they need that they're not currently getting. And we're coming, toward the end of that project. The final assessment will be coming out soon. We've got the draft scenarios online for people to give their input on. But what we're going to be looking at is increasing the frequency of service. So, a lot of routes, it's like an hour and a half between buses. But there are certain routes that would really benefit from, service every 30 minutes. And this will make it easier for people who are commuting, who are using it for, it's just having more frequent service. Again, will increase ridership and meet needs better. We're also going to be extending certain routes and reducing wait times at connections. So those are the goals of the assessment. Once we have the final recommendations, we'll be implementing them beginning in 2025 over a three-year period. And a change that I had proposed to help fund these improvements that the legislature approved this year was creating an occupancy tax policy that dedicates 25% of occupancy tax revenues, which is like, you know, bed tax on short-term rentals, hotels, motels, 25% of those revenues to transportation, another 25% to housing, another priority, and that'll help fund these improvements. We're also applying for funding for a micro transit program. I'm very excited about this because, you know, most kind of micro transit on demand, programs or initiatives are usually private sector, or it's the public sector contracting with the private sector to provide these services, something along the lines of like Lyft, Uber, those kinds of things. And we're looking to do this with our public transit system. It's a pilot program. We've applied for $3.4 million in funding from the State Department of Transportation as part of their Innovative Mobility Initiative. And the idea is that for communities where we have a lot of residents who don't own personal transportation. So that includes Ellenville, where, you know, I think something along the lines of 17% to 18% of residents don't have personal transportation, as well as the city of Kingston. New Paltz is also an area. We're going to pilot a public on-demand service to help people either get directly to, say, shopping plazas and appointments, or else if they're not on a bus route, the service can connect them with buses that will take them to where they need to go. So we're very excited about that, and, you know, we feel like we're a strong candidate for this grant. And, I've included it in the budget for next year. So stay tuned, but we're thrilled about that.
The executive budget also includes some approaches to address service gaps with emergency medical services in Ulster County. What are some of those gaps, and what will the budget do to help close those gaps?
Yeah, so, you know, this isn't just an Ulster County problem. It's like, it's a state problem. It's a national problem. You know, emergency medical services have, you know, long relied on volunteers. And as we know, just, you know, across the board, it's very difficult. A recruitment of volunteers is very difficult in today's economy. You know, we do have, it's often like a mix of like paid and volunteer or all volunteer. It's a total hodgepodge in our communities across Ulster County. And many areas have, you know, very strong service and are in good shape. But there are some other areas where they have service gaps, particularly in advanced life support or ALS service. So we are, we're encouraging and supporting municipalities to take multi-jurisdictional approaches to this, which will basically collaborating, like taking a group of towns and you know, entering into a shared contract for service, which just increases, it just makes service pencil out better because there are more calls. The call volume is higher, and we're helping by providing the county emergency services department is providing technical expertise, and we're also going to be providing some legal expertise to help communities do that. In addition, we are, you know, really focused on addressing, like, head on the recruitment issues. We're creating, our emergency services department is joining forces with SUNY Ulster to apply to the state to create EMS certification programs in the county. There is only one now, and they literally have to turn, they have to turn people away from it because they just are not, they don't have enough room. So expanding that, we're also creating a new work study incentive program for to complete certification and also to incentivize you know, service in the field. There's a lot. We're also creating an EMS training program within the emergency services department just to help keep EMS personnel up to date in their training. And lastly, we're creating a grant program to assist volunteer EMS services in purchasing equipment that bolsters their capability to provide a higher level of patient care. So, CPR machines, things that will enable them to provide a higher level of care while they're waiting for ALS support. So it's a fairly large package of initiatives. I do want to mention that an important bill was just signed into law by the governor. It was a bill sponsored by our state senator here in Ulster County, or a good portion of Ulster County, Michelle Hinchey. And what that does is essentially enable paramedics to bill insurance and to basically treat people on site rather than always having to take them to a hospital. They can treat them on site and bill for it, or they can take them to an urgent care facility, or if it's a mental health issue, they can take them to a behavioral health facility. Right now, the law is so restrictive the way the regulations are set up, and it just makes no sense to have to drive everyone to a hospital when that's like not what they necessarily need. Yeah. So I think that's going to really help bolster those services.
Yeah, we had mentioned that in some other earlier reporting, but now instead of just transporting patients to hospital ERs, they're able to have new reimbursement sources and expanding the ability for folks to administer life-saving treatment. We, as you said, there's a lot. There are 11 priorities in this budget, but we don't have time to go to all of them here, but the legislature is bringing this budget directly to the public with three public hearings across the county to gather public feedback, and then they'll vote on that once they receive that and then go through any of their updates or amendments in December. So those meetings are coming up starting in November 12th?
Yep. No, the first one is in November 12th, 6 p.m. at the Plattekville Public Library. The next one is November 14th at 6 p.m. at the Woodstock Community Center. And the third public hearing is on November 19th. In legislative chambers right here in Kingston at 7 p.m. So I encourage the public to go to the Ulster County website. You can review the budget, budget summary, the whole budget if you'd like, hundreds and hundreds of pages. I think it's so important for our residents to have an understanding of, you know, of the budget of the county, what we're prioritizing, what we're investing in, and we'd love their feedback.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. We have been talking to Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger about the proposed 2025 budget of $432 million, which will now go to the public for public hearings, as we mentioned, starting November 12th. And then the Ulster County Legislature will vote on that December 10th. And the hearings are going to be live streamed on the legislature's YouTube channel as well. Thank you so much, Jen Metzger, for joining us, and we appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tim. Yes, my pleasure.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the hotly contested attorney general's race in Pennsylvania and how each of those candidates plans to tackle the opioid crisis in the Commonwealth. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome back.
Bryan Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvania's next attorney general will set the tone of the Commonwealth's approach to law enforcement, and one of the biggest tasks they'll face is deciding how to handle the ongoing opioid crisis. According to CDC data, Pennsylvania's rate of death due to opioids peaked in 2017. It's since declined to 14th in the country as of 2022, with 40.9 deaths per 100,000 people. Still, that death toll is high. 500-plus Pennsylvanians died from an overdose in 2022, the most recent year. Full data is available for that. Both major party candidates for Attorney General, Democrat Eugene DePasquale and Republican Dave Sunday, argue harm reduction should be part of the Commonwealth's approach to the opioid crisis and have focused on getting people who use drugs into treatment rather than prison. Spotlight PA's Capitol reporter Stephen Caruso is covering Pennsylvania's high-stakes attorney general's race, and he spoke to Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio about how the candidates plan to approach the opioid epidemic.
Dave Sunday is the York County District Attorney. This is a mid-sized county in central Pennsylvania with a small city at the core of it. He has seen firsthand a lot of issues within the crisis. York is also a crossroads between Philadelphia, Baltimore, D.C. I had a chance to talk to him, and what he says, that led to a large spike in fentanyl and other opioid drugs being brought in. So as a deputy prosecutor and the elected district attorney, he dealt with this hand-on. He built a coalition to try and expand hospital beds. He held community meetings. He equipped cops with naloxone. That's an overdose-reversing drug. And it did see some results. York County is now below the statewide average in overdoses, and there's been just an overall reduction in deaths. For Sunday, it's been this really hands-on approach that he has had throughout his time as district attorney. He poses it as he believes in accountability as well as redemption. Then Eugene DePasquale, he hasn't been a prosecutor, but he's the former state's auditor general. But and going back even before that, his father was a Vietnam vet who was injured and then became addicted to heroin and other opioids, ended up selling drugs, and went to jail for 10 years. Throughout his time as auditor general, which is a separate position, but he spent a lot of time focusing on rehab. The state's like how the state helps people who are dealing with addiction. He backed fentanyl test strip legalization before that was the case. They lawmakers finally got around to about a year ago. I think it was maybe 2 years ago. But DePasquale backed that. He's backed legalizing marijuana. And he just said in general supports trying to expand how the state provides people who are dealing with addiction, grappling with it, how they get access to care to try to avoid anyone going through the experience I think he had with his father who went through the criminal justice system.
Yeah, you talk about, I just want to focus a little bit on Eugene. I see he often talks about his personal connection to the opioid crisis. How do you think his experience with addiction in his family influenced his policies?
I think it seems like he's definitely backed some harm reduction policies. I mentioned fentanyl test strips. That's something that was controversial in Pennsylvania. I'd say our General Assembly is it's a place where tough on crime still flies. And having the Auditor General, the top cop of the state, who regularly cooperates with local and federal authorities to go after anyone from a street dealer to a pharmacist who's unlawfully distributing drugs, illicit or not, having that mindset could definitely be a plus if you're somebody who's thinking about it from that perspective, just on his personal experience too. It even goes so far as the DePasquale campaign said they support safe consumption sites. These are areas where someone who can consume drugs under medical supervision, they can get clean needles. The idea is that this reduces overdose deaths. It reduces health complications such as transmitting HIV or other diseases that you transmit through blood-to-blood contact. He said he supports them. That was something that even our former Democratic Auditor General, Josh Shapiro, opposed and as a Attorney General and still opposes as governor. That, to me, really shows that it seems like harm reduction is one of the biggest angles that DePasquale brings to this the opioid crisis from his vantage point.
Yeah, no, definitely. Now, and now let's look at Dave Sunday. I see most of his campaign is held on holding drug traffickers accountable. Can you go more into his stance on this and his record as York County's district attorney?
Yeah, one of the main things with Sunday, too, is that he is among the top prosecutors who use this drug charge, you know, with drug delivery resulting in death. It basically means that if law enforcement is able to track the drugs as somebody who died of an overdose, and they're able to find the person who sold those drugs or gave those drugs to the person who overdosed, they could charge them with a felony. It could be up to 40 years in prison, in fact. This is something that I think become more common and other states have passed, Pennsylvania among them, within the country in response to the crisis, but actually Pennsylvania, going back to this idea that we're a tough on crime state that in some ways, Pennsylvania's been one of the top states for using it, and Sunday has been among the top prosecutors in using it. Since he became DA of York County, he's tied for second largest total in the whole Commonwealth. Now, I asked Sunday about this. Let me back up and say criminal justice reformers don't like this charge because they say they're worried that it means people won't actually call for help if there's an overdose because they're going to worry about being caught up in a law enforcement investigation and trying to seek help. And also that it's mostly used against people of color and also just friends and family. And it's not just used against an anonymous drug dealer. It's often used against someone close to the person who died. I did ask Sunday about this, and he said that he's heard this criticism, but he pointed out, look, I've also advocated for the Good Samaritan laws that try to shield people who report overdoses from prosecution. And he's also said this is just a fraction of the charges I brought. And he just argued, though, that accountability is part of the criminal justice system, and you know, that is why he's used this charge, among many others, when trying to address it. So it's definitely, I think York County has seen results, but there's no way to get around that this sort of tough-on-crime approach of using the drug delivery resulting in death charge is part of his approach.
Right. And you mentioned, I'm going to go back a little bit, you mentioned about supervised injection sites and other harm reduction strategies. You mentioned how it could be a contentious topic in this race. Does Sunday support that also? Or has he ever commented on that sort of strategy?
Not super specifically. I asked the spokesperson for Sunday who said he opposes them. Look, I think what you can say is that I will say Sunday has really seems to be trying to do both a bit of harm reduction and a bit of tough on crime. I know that probably it's a hard balance to have, but looking at the York County Opioid Cooperative, which is this public-private partnership he helped found, that includes trying to, if York County police interact with somebody who was potentially involved in a crime but is clearly dealing with addiction, they try to get them help. They try to get them in the rehab. They try to set them up to avoid interfacing with the criminal justice system at all if the issue they're dealing with is addiction. I think he seems very aware of this as a problem. He's also tried to cooperate with local healthcare providers to make sure meds are available, to facilitate these warm hands-offs. But also, it's just there's this side of it, too, is just going after. He also talks a lot. This isn't exactly opioids, but like he helped prosecute gang violence in New York. He's gone after, I think, the most prototypical idea of the like random criminal who haunts city streets. And I think there's no way to look at Sunday's record that doesn't try to balance. And I think that's what his campaign is trying to do, is paint this picture of someone who wants to balance both the instinct of folks to care for those who have maybe come to crime, come to addiction because of hardship in their life, while also trying to lock up people in jail who seem like they deserve to be in jail.
Yeah. Now, given that the Attorney General's role includes the discretion in when it's prosecuting drug cases, how do you think each candidate would approach these cases differently, especially if like low level versus like high level offenders?
I think that's hard. It's hard to say to an extent because we can only point to Dave Sunday's only one prosecutorial experience. DePasquale is an attorney. You have to be an attorney to be attorney general. But other than that, he's never been in a courtroom to prosecuting cases like this. I will say DePasquale has talked a lot about he wants to make sure that he has a very strong role in how opioid settlement money is used. These are the settlements that opioid manufacturers, distributors, healthcare companies overall have made with states to make up for their perceived role in the spread of opioids, proliferation of them into people's houses and then their use. And that's sending hundreds of millions of dollars to states. Our attorney general doesn't actually have a direct role within the spending, which was on this court-ordered board. But DePasquale has said he still wants to try and have an active voice in that conversation, use the, I would still say, substantial bully pulpit and powers of the attorney general to push for this to be used for rehab and other things that help people kick addiction. He hasn't commented super specifically. I'll say I asked his campaign if they had a comment on the drug delivery resulting in death charge. DePasquale didn't comment. So I think that how exactly DePasquale's values translate into that, what it's like if a charge hits his desk is, I think, something I can't really answer. But he's tried to make his values, I think, pretty clear.
Now, all eyes are going to be on Pennsylvania for this election. And for this race, for all the races that are going on, actually, of course, the presidential race. But what should Pennsylvania voters understand about the broader implications of this race and how the next attorney general could impact the state's approach to drug addiction and even public safety?
Yeah, I think it's if, you know, a lot of ads talk about crime, a lot of ads talk about public safety. I think attorney general is one position that actually does have a direct role in it. They, like I said, they cooperate with local and national authorities to try and go after drug traffickers. The amount of times they get inboxes where it's talking about sweeps or gun crimes, drug crimes, whatever, they have some role in that. I'll say, too, the attorney general necessarily doesn't go into courtrooms often. I don't think Josh Shapiro ever made his way into a courtroom as attorney general, but they're a manager of a lot of attorneys and a lot of law enforcement resources. Now, this is an office that does a lot of other stuff, too. They also have a big role in consumer protection. They appoint a state officer who's there to stand up for folks who are dealing with utility concerns. They also do like grand juries on things like child sexual abuse. So it's a very big office. It has a lot of responsibilities, but just in general, if when you're looking at who to vote for, I think attorney general is the closest thing you get to dictating what will our state's public safety mindset look like. And attorney general is the office to vote for.
Stephen, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about your article and this upcoming race?
I'll say Spotlight PA, if you're a Pennsylvanian, Spotlight PA has done a bunch of these issue guides on the attorney general's race, trying to look at abortion, voting, guns, opioids was my addition to this. We also have quizzes if folks don't want to read an article. We have it for the other row office races as well, auditor general, state treasurer. These races are just as important as the presidency, as the U.S. Senate. Don't forget your state legislature. There are offices up and down the ballot. Be thoughtful. And if you're going to go vote, all of them can matter.
We were talking to Stephen Caruso, the Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. You can find his article on Spotlight PA or our website at wjffradio.org. Stephen, thank you so much for talking to us about this upcoming race and the important election that is happening for Pennsylvania and for the nation.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Radio Chatskill. This Halloween, you might be thinking about the perfect costume or the best candy, but the National Fire Protection Association wants people to think about something a little different this year, safety. Decorating with jack-o'-lanterns or other seasonal items, costume parties, and trick-or-treating all present potential fire hazards. The National Fire Protection Association warns that between 2018 and 2022, an annual average of 830 home structure fires began with decorations, resulting in $14 million in direct property damage. Radio Catskill's Nia Watson met with Sullivan County Fire Coordinator to help learn more about staying safe this Halloween.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is John Hauschild. I'm the Sullivan County Fire Coordinator, and part of my duties is a liaison with all 40 fire departments here in Sullivan County and work very closely with EMS and law enforcement as well. I am also the Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety for Sullivan County. So we have a lot of responsibilities, and part of the fire coordinator's position is to help with recruitment and retention, fire safety, and different safety tips for the general public.
Wonderful. I'd like to really talk about that fire safety today. So the National Fire Protection Association reports that decorations are a cause of an average 835 home fires annually. We're approaching Halloween. It's a big holiday for decorations. Can you talk about how decorations fires typically start and what are some steps that folks can take when decorating to prevent a fire?
So first of all, I just want to say that Halloween, we shouldn't scare anybody. Halloween is a fun time. All the monsters come out and everything. So it's huge that we stress that everybody needs to have a great time, but we're going to do it safely. We have to do it safely. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Getting back to your question about decorations and houses. So there's a lot of different safety things that we need to do when we're decorating a house. One is, everybody puts up the cobwebs and the spiders and all that. We just have to make sure that they're not near any open flame, candles, fireplace, you know, wood stove, anything like that, because they are combustible. They will ignite when the temperature gets just right. So we have to use caution, keep them so many feet away. And decorations are great. They're fun, but you don't ever want to block an exit. And the decorations, again, just if they are fire retardant, that's great. If they're not, just keep them safe distance away and use caution.
Thank you. So I have a question about a different type of decoration that's very specific to Halloween, jack-o'-lanterns.
Yes.
Jack-o'-lanterns, if using an open fire, a candle, can obviously pose a risk. Do you have any tips or suggestions for people looking to maybe make jack-o'-lanterns or do a similar type of activity and exercise that fire safety?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The jack-o'-lanterns are great when you get that flickering inside of them and everything. So there are a lot of different things. You can use glow sticks. You can use a different glow stick every night. And they do have battery operated candles. So instead of using a candle where it's going to burn down and possibly start a fire, you can use those other things. And, you know, you can turn them on and off, which is great. You know, a candle, once you light it, it's lit and you forget about it and get busy or you fall asleep. But there are different options. I would highly recommend glow sticks and the battery operated candles. And they do make that flickering thing and they're bright enough. Now they're all LED lights, so they're pretty bright.
So fire safety isn't something that only adults practice. How do you recommend folks teach their kids about exercising fire safety this Halloween?
When they're decorating, keep it away from open flame. If they're buying costumes, make sure the costume fits. Make sure it's not loose clothing, you know, with like a trailer or a tail where it could knock over an open flame. And they just have to teach their kids to be very careful when they're entering a house or walking around a house or a Halloween party. You know, the other safety thing is if they do have a costume, make sure if it covers their face that they have holes cut out for their eyes and nose so they can breathe properly and see properly. And I think that's important for parents to have that discussion with their children before Halloween.
So similar question, but a little bit different. Young children, children who, you know, typically cannot be left unattended, they can be curious and might accidentally touch or knock over things. What are some planning tips that people with younger children can exercise?
It's pretty much the same thing, but if you could put those decorations up higher where the children can't get to it, and don't have things where children can climb. We all know that they are curious, like you said, and they want to explore. They can make a ladder out of anything and they can climb up. So we just want to use extreme caution with that, especially if you have a candle burning or stuff like that. Get it up high so they can't reach it.
Yes, thank you. Moving on to costume safety, you mentioned it earlier. So can you share any other types of clothing that could be a bit risky in terms of fire safety or safety in general and any alternatives that you recommend?
That's hard because if they're buying pre-made costumes, you can read the back of the label and see if they are fabric that won't ignite. And if they do have webbing or anything that's loose, you know, that is easily ignitable. You just have to look at the costumes. You know, some of the best ones are the homemade costumes.
Agreed. Homemade costumes can be both fun to make and to wear. So smoke alarms, they're very essential for emergencies. And oftentimes people don't think about them at first or think about them often enough. Can you talk about the importance of keeping smoke alarms well maintained?
Sure, absolutely. Halloween falls right behind Fire Prevention Week, which is the National Fire Protection Association. There's 1 week, but fire prevention just doesn't stop there. And we talk about smoke alarms and stuff during Fire Prevention Week, and we say that fire prevention is all year through. Usually with the battery operated ones, we say every time the time changes, the batteries change. So Halloween is just before the time change. So that could be a good time to change the batteries as well, or make sure that they work. The new smoke detectors today are 10-year life, and then you throw them away and get new ones. Just a little tip with that is make sure you mark the detector, if it is a 10-year smoke detector, to mark the date so you can see when it was put up. For instance, you put it up in 2020. In 2030, it needs to be replaced. Or, of course, if it starts chirping or making noises earlier, then it has to be replaced. But again, Halloween is a good time to change your batteries, check them, test them, make sure that they work. Because, you know, if you do use candles or stuff like that, you always have that potential and you want to make sure that they work and your family's safe.
And so on Halloween, like other holidays, people can get caught up in the festivities, the parties, trick-or-treating, and other activities like that. And obviously, it's important to know how to handle an emergency in advance to prevent panic in the moment. In the event of a home fire, what are some tips, safety tips, that people can take so that they can think about this in advance, you know, talk through it with their families, and know what to do in the event of an emergency?
So we talked a little bit about that earlier. You always want to have your exits clear so you can get out in the event of an emergency. We talk about in the fire service with fire safety are the exit drills in the home, and it's called EDITH. You need to evacuate the house if the smoke alarm goes off and go to a meeting place. Everybody should have a meeting place where they all gather up, because if one goes behind the house, some go in front of the house, you don't know. You think somebody's still inside and they're actually out. But the most important safety tip is get out of the house safely and never return back into the house. Don't go back in for your pet, your stuffed toy. Just get out, stay out, and then let the firefighters come in and do their job. But again, most important prior to that is have this plan done. Make sure the exits are free. Smoke alarms are working. Don't panic. Don't panic. It's easy to say not to panic, but if you see fire or there's smoke in the house, it's kind of hard not to panic because that's your life.
Staying calm and being able to make sure you're making good logical decisions is important in moments like that. So you talked a bit about outdoor decorations earlier, but can you talk a bit about how people can exercise that safety with other things that tend to go along with holidays? Sparklers, grills, hot plates. What are some suggestions, tips, advice that you have?
Sure. So outside the house, people love to decorate. We talked about the jack-o'-lanterns with the candles. That's part of it. And a lot of people like to have campfires, and they sit around and they have cider and donuts and they tell ghost stories. And that's great. That's a lot of fun. But you also have to be very careful, especially this time of year. We're in extreme dry conditions right now. And if you have an outside fire and you are done for the evening and you go inside and you leave that burn, sparks can easily ignite the leaves. Everybody knows this time of year, the leaves come down because we have to rake them. And you know, it could catch the leaves on fire, the woods on fire, and eventually it could possibly even catch your house on fire, which we do not want. So if you do have an outside fire, just make sure it's extinguished before you go in and never leave an open flame. And the other thing is, if you do have an outside fire, make sure that all the leaves are away from your fire pit. You know, and even a gas grill, you know, has the potential of possibly a spark. If the grill's not in good shape, it could ignite the ground or your decking, or if you have the grill too close to the wall of the house, it could catch that as well. But just have fun, be careful.
And so my final question, John, is what is something about fire safety that most people don't know?
This is a great opportunity talking with you today is to get the word out to the public. The fire departments do a great job going to the schools and educating the kids. And the kids come back home and tell their parents. And sometimes the parents forget about it. And, oh, well, we'll do that later. And later never happens. So that message kind of gets forgotten. You know, we try to get this word out as much as possible. Like you said, the National Fire Protection Association put out these safety tips. There's different websites. The Office of Fire Prevention Control in Albany have sites that you can go get safety material on fires. And some people get embarrassed because they don't know and they don't want to ask that question. I'd rather spend 15, 20 minutes chatting with somebody to explain the safety tips and making everybody's life easier and enjoyable.
Thank you, Sullivan County Fire Coordinator John Hausschild, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Nia Watson for Radio Catskill.
And thanks to Nia for that. So that'll do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. Be sure to stay safe this spooky season. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
This is Radio Catskill, WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.